welcome to Engage UK. I'm your host, Elizabeth Reardon, here on Real Life Radio. Now, I'm so happy to be here today to meet you where you are and to look at where God is leading us together in faith. Now, today's show is with a good friend, Margaret Felice, who has graciously agreed to join us now and every other Friday here on An Engaging Faith. And if you are listening in and wish to talk to Margaret or I, the number is 855-949-1380. Again, 855-949-1380. Now today we're going to be talking about all things Catholic, Catholic events, Catholic news, and maybe at the end, a few of the Catholic books that we're reading. And so Margaret is a religion teacher at Boston College High by day and an opera singer, actress by night. She conducts liturgical choirs and is a blogger, writer over at MargaretFelice.com. Margaret, so awesome to have you on again today and to have you come on as a regularly scheduled guest.
Yes, yes. I've been looking forward to this since the last time we chatted 2 weeks ago. And as I was joking with you on Twitter the other day, and folks should know they can find us both on Twitter, Elizabeth is at Theology is a Verb, and mine is at Margaret Felice. Preparing for this always keeps me really up to date on the latest in Catholic news. It forces me to do my research and make sure I know what I'm talking about. So it's a real grace for me just to prepare for our conversations. And then when we have them, it's grace on top of grace.
Well, I will tell you, one of the things is that when you're in Catholic social media, that you are bombarded with Catholic news 24/7. And being able to take that time to read it and to kind of digest it so that you can understand all the different points, because everything, there isn't really one Catholic view. I mean, there's such diversity, as Pope Francis would say, there's room for difference.
Yes. I always love that quote from James Joyce that is, Catholicism means here comes everybody. There's so many perspectives and so many emphases. And in a way, I find that really liberating because it means I don't have to do it all myself. I don't have to feel passionately about every issue. I can focus on the things that I want to change and promote in the world and know that there are other people doing the other things because there is so much diversity in the church.
That's a really great way of looking at it. Yesterday, when we were talking about the Church of Mercy by Pope Francis, that book published by Loyola Press, one of the analogies he used was that the Catholic Church was like an orchestra, and that we don't all play the same instrument or the same tone, that we have these varying tones and these added gifts that really make the music sound what it's supposed to be.
Yeah. Oh, wow. What a phenomenal image. I mean, as a musician, obviously,
right,
that really speaks to me, and I spent quite a bit of last week out at Notre Dame as part of their Notre Dame Vision Conference. They started a track for liturgical music ministers. So I was able to present two morning talks with 24 music ministers from around the world, as far as New Zealand. And there was mostly from the United States, but from all over the world. And it was really a blessing to think in those sort of musical terms again. So I really love that image of the church as an orchestra. It keys in with a lot of the things I've been thinking about lately after this experience at Notre Dame.
And I would say that it's very apt. It's a very apt description, because when you go to listen to a concert, you know, sure there are times when you might want to listen to a brass ensemble or a woodwind ensemble, you know, a group of instruments that are just playing a certain range or a certain piece. But what is beautiful is understanding that if you've ever, and I know you have, obviously, for those listening, though, that have ever attended a big orchestra production, that understanding that from the smallest piccolo to the largest tuba, there is a place in that orchestra for them. There is a time in which what they bring to that music is so important.
And the infinite combinations that you can create.
Yes. It
just means that there is so many possibilities, sonic possibilities and creative possibilities. So, gosh, we can really milk that analogy for all it's worth. There's a lot going on in there. That's great.
It is. So the first, let's start off with some of the items making the news this week. I know that first off, Father Robert Barron, the announcement of him as Bishop of Los Angeles.
Yeah, what big news there. And I almost feel bad. There were two other auxiliary bishops also named to Los Angeles. They're both priests of the Archdiocese, and they're not getting any attention. I almost feel bad for them because they're totally in Robert Barron's shadow. He is such a towering figure in the new evangelization.
Well, right. And they're listed and they're there, but I think everyone's eyes and attention just goes, boom, mm-hmm. right? You know, and with good reason. I mean, he's been called the next Bishop Sheen, who we all yeah. know was in the 1950s primetime, you know, inspirational host. But, you know, and some of the other titles that I was grabbing for the headlines, one which said, Pope Francis appoints Catholic YouTube star to LA Archdiocese. And that's from the Huffington Post. But, I mean, I think that while that's cute, I think that it doesn't give credit to all the things that Father Robert Barron does. That's not necessarily in the limelight. Like his work with Modaline Seminary.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I noticed that too. I think, again, there are certain things that just, they get overshadowed by the glamour of being a YouTube star, if you can put it that way. But he's obviously a very accomplished, very bright intellectual, but not in a way that causes him to alienate others or put himself above other people. I think from my experience of doing religious education in a high school setting, I find that the hardest thing to do when you have a lot of information is figure out what's the simplest and what's essential. And his gift for communicating things simply, I think, demonstrates a real expertise in education and evangelization.
Now, do you use his videos in your classrooms?
I have occasionally, but I have to admit I'm not terribly familiar with sort of the range of his work. There are a few things, like if there is maybe a particular saint that I want to highlight and I find a video from his ministry that highlights that saint, I will use it, but I haven't looked through sort of the whole library or catalog, so to speak, in order to find additional resources.
Well, my son Peter, he returned, you know, would return at the end of the day, and I'd ask him about his classes, and he said, oh, well, you know, Father Robert Barron says.
That's great.
And it was hysterical because before this year at Sacred Heart, I don't think he really understood what it meant to be a Catholic that was out there in that sphere, other than the Pope.
Yeah. Well, being in a Jesuit school, we tend to use a lot of videos from Father James Martin, from America Magazine, Loyola Press. We tend to skew towards the Jesuit resources sort of as a professional
right.
courtesy. But it really is phenomenal, some of the things that you can find to enrich the classroom and just to enrich your own education by watching things on your own.
Well, speaking of that, so he's leaving this post at Modaline Seminary in Chicago, which trains, I think this last year, it's had 200 seminarians currently enrolled. So it's considered one of the largest seminaries in the U.S. And that really, Father Robert Barron leaving, opens up a position for Archbishop Supich to fill.
Yeah, and I wish I were a church whisperer and I could tell you who I think would fill that
role, but it will certainly be fascinating to see how someone continues his work there and how Supich continues to put together
his team
in Chicago. A lot of people are making a lot of hay out of that as to that being sort of why Barron was moved. And I'm not sure I'd say that because he's obviously a worthy leader. And I find it very interesting that, I think the world of the bishops, and most of them are extraordinary men, but there has been this sort of stereotype of, you know, the politicking and the schmoozing, and it's a certain kind of person that is elevated to the office of bishop. And I found it very interesting to think about that sort of change. You know, it's not enough to be a schmoozer. When I think of the kind of things that Barron has done and the way that he's engaged that make him so uniquely suited to the 21st century, I was struck by that contrast between sort of the old style and the new style of Episcopal leader.
Right. And Pope Francis has made it quite clear that he wasn't looking for the old style, that he wants to do things different. And I think that, and I would agree with you as to his leaving Chicago and going to LA, I don't think that it's supposed to send any grand sign.
Yeah.
So we are going to be taking a break, but when we come back, we're going to hear more from Margaret Felice this afternoon here on An Engaging Faith with Elizabeth Riordan on Real Life Radio. Welcome back, and you are listening to An Engaging Faith with Elizabeth Riordan here on Real Life Radio. Now, Real Life Radio is you supported, and we are so thankful to you, our supporter and listener. Know of someone else who might enjoy listening? Pass it on. Want to find out who you are in this exciting journey of evangelization? Check out realliferadio.com. Now, before the break, Margaret and I were discussing Father Robert Barron's announcement as Bishop of Los Angeles, but there have been other news that have been circulated around the Catholic sphere as well. One of the biggest things is that mayors from capitals of around the world are meeting or have met to discuss climate change and human trafficking at the Vatican. So, Margaret, you know, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is there.
Yes. I was hoping, you know, I'm a resident of Boston. I actually live in the same neighborhood as the mayor. I hold him in very high regard. I think he's a great leader. And I was sort of sitting here waiting with my bag packed, hoping that he would decide that he needed a translator, someone who spoke Italian to take with him. But, I did not get the call, so I had to watch from afar. He met with Ambassador Ken Hackett, who is also from Boston, the U.S. Ambassador to the Vatican, who is the former head of Catholic Relief Services. He's actually a BC High grad, so I've been able to hear him speak at Boston College High School in the past. I like seeing things get done. I think it's really easy to look at these conferences, and it seems like there's a professional sniping class. People who say, oh, well, so-and-so shouldn't be there, or they shouldn't be meeting with the Pope because they're not perfect Catholics, or this is stupid, they're not getting anything done. I feel like there's so many possible criticisms that you can come up with for an endeavor like this, and I just love seeing the church try things, seeing them just do things. It might not be perfect, but it's so fascinating, and it is in continuity with a lot of the things that the Pope wrote in his new encyclical. There were sort of 2 days of talks. The first one focused on modern-day slavery, exploitation, and how that relates to climate change, which is a big emphasis of the Pope when he talks about climate change. And the second one is about sustainable development.
Urban development, climate change, and social inclusion.
Yeah. One of the things that I really liked was that as part of this conference with all the other mayors, Bill de Blasio of New York stated his goal of reducing carbon emissions. I think it's by 40% in by 2030, maybe. And so in 15 years, I haven't quite seen a concrete action plan from Mayor Walsh yet. So I would like to see that.
Right.
That'd be something I'd be interested in. And also hearing how a lot of these other mayors are going to take the inspiration that they got from hearing the Pope and also the ideas that they got from hearing from all the other mayors. I'm interested in seeing how some of these different mayors from around the world put things into action based on the conversations that they had.
Right. And I agree. One of the things that Brown had said, Mayor Brown, Governor of California, Jerry Brown, mm-hmm. had said that it was considering local action to fighting climate change was like the struggle of changing the direction of a massive ship.
Mm, yeah.
And I thought, well, at least he's being realistic, because what I hate coming out of these conferences is, oh, yes, this is what we're going to do. But there's no recognition of the challenge that we're facing.
Mm-hmm. And that you need to be super specific and super intentional about what your goals are, rather than just saying, like you said, oh, we'll just make it better.
Right. Well, these are some of the from the full text of the Common Declaration, one of the statements was, all of our cultural traditions uphold the inherent dignity and social responsibility of every individual and the related common good of all humanity. They affirm the beauty, wonder, and inherent goodness of the natural world and appreciate that it is a precious gift entrusted to our common care, making it our moral duty to steward rather than ravage the garden that is our common home.
Nice.
And I really liked that quote, because it said, okay, it was taking a very Christian and Catholic way of looking at things, even though they may not all share the same faith tradition, but it is respecting that in that forum, that these are principles that underlie the fabric of our country.
And most urban mayors, and as far as I know, these were all mayors of large cities, they have really diverse populations economically, and they have a lot of the poor and vulnerable under their care. So they really have to be thinking about, how does climate change disproportionately affect the most vulnerable, which is something that most statistics will show, and that the Pope has harped on as well, in terms of one of the reasons, it being one of the reasons why he wants to focus on climate change. So a lot of these people, these leaders who were there, have these communities of need. And this is just another way that they can, in sort of the big picture, try to tend to the needs of those people.
Right. And I think a lot of people aren't seeing the connection between, like, let's say, climate change and human trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
But very realistically, when our poor are needing to leave an area, they often go into the cities and they put themselves even more at risk to being, you know, taken advantage of. And that is where what this meeting was calling for is active work by the mayors and the governments to look at ways to, first of all, reduce the amount of time that our poor are left outside in bad economic conditions, and also to work towards ways to give them gainful employment, ways to lift them out of where they are so that they don't have to be put in these situations that place them at risk, that make them even more vulnerable.
Yeah, the issue of vulnerability, it's just, I mean, it's such a shame, and it's so disheartening to think about how many predators there are out there and people who will take advantage of the vulnerable. But it's the reality.
Right. Now, there is, you know, it's not without objections, as you said. Cardinal Pell is one of those that has come up to object against a lot of what's coming out of the Laudato Si. But he was the one, if you can remember, was given the mandate to reform the Vatican's banking affairs.
Mm-hmm.
So, but despite this, despite his, I would say, criticism, he has also come very forward and said, well, the encyclical is being very well received. And that it has beautifully set out our obligations to future generations and our obligations to the environment. So even the ones that are disagreeing are recognizing that what the Pope is saying is falling on fertile ground as well, that it is taking root.
Indeed.
So looking towards, let's see, our next topic, let's talk about the Christians facing the threat of kidnapping in Syria and Iraq. Now, this is a problem that people will say, gosh, hasn't that been around forever? But it's really intensified recently.
Yeah, it's ISIS has really become a nefarious force in the Middle East. And as far as we can tell, most of these kidnappings, holding people for ransom, religious violence, comes the more extreme versions, which, like you said, unfortunately, there has been violence against Christians in a lot of areas for a long time, but it has been amped up as ISIS takes over and frankly begins terrorizing these cities and towns throughout the Middle East.
Right. Some of the outtakes that are coming out from the Middle East right now, from Syria and Iraq, are that the perpetrators are, and I quote, falsifying the documents of Christian homes and seizing them and their household goods. Threatening messages are also being sent through the mobile phones, ordering them to leave their jobs. And, you know, it's because of this that even those that have been there for so long and have withstood so much already, the kidnapping and the killing is just increasing, and many are having to leave the lands of their ancestors. Now, we don't think about that every day, but, you know, what would it be like to have to say goodbye to America forever?
Yeah, there's a huge, huge refugee movement. And the people who don't leave, I mean, some of the stories that we're hearing, it sounds, the things that you mentioned and even more more awful stories, it sounds like Europe on the eve of the Second World War and the Holocaust. I mean, it's this sort of serious brutality. So
right.
I wish I had the answer, but I think people do need to know what's going on in that part of the world. And no matter what your religious background is, you should be concerned about this sort of persecution.
And we are going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to hear more from Margaret Felice this afternoon here on An Engaging Faith with Elizabeth Reardon on Real Life Radio. Welcome back, and you are listening to An Engaging Faith with Elizabeth Reardon here on Real Life Radio. Now, Real Life Radio is you supported, and we are so thankful to you, our supporter and listener. Now, when we look at the topics for today, we had so many to cover, so we're going to quickly try to touch on some of the others that are making the headlines today. And one of which is the call for more priests to enlist as military chaplains to kind of step forward and answer a call within a call. So for those that do not understand the duties of a military chaplain, without the priest there, most of our soldiers will go quite a while especially out in the field, without having the Eucharist, without having that presence of community, without hearing the word spoken and being present as part of that, just that community of faith. Now, there is not only a shortage of priests that we say, even though we've had an increasing number, I think, this year, but there's a critical shortage of military chaplains. So they are having an event, the first, I think, event of its kind for ordained priests, to, as a retreat for young men and priests to kind of come and consider that their place might be serving for our soldiers.
Yeah, I was really interested to read the article about that, the gathering that they're going to have in D.C. in October for that purpose. Like I said in one of our previous segments, I just love seeing that sort of creativity in meeting new challenges in the church and just trying new things. I mean, what a challenge. One of the things that they were saying in the article that I read about it is, you know, they have plenty of priests who are willing to serve in a VA hospital, for instance.
Right.
But it's a lot harder to find folks who will go abroad, who will be in
harm's way.
Yeah, exactly. Who will be in harm's way. So there's the fact that there is so much military involvement around the world, I think, presents a challenge in sort of increasing the staffing needs. But there are so many men and women that are doing so much good work around the world and are often put in those very stressful situations where the need for companionship and the sacramental life can be even more acute. I think it's such a worthy cause.
Right. So for anyone interested or know of a priest or a young seminarian that might be interested, the meeting is called For God and Country, A Call to Serve Those Who Serve, and they'll be held October 5th through 9th in Washington, D.C. Interested priests can apply for the all-expensive-paid gathering through the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C.'s website. So the other issue that came up was the lifting of and the opening of the embassies in Cuba. So what do you think about that, Margaret?
Well, I think this is sort of a theme for me today. I guess I'm feeling like a woman of action today. I feel like the relationship was so stagnant and it had been sort of stuck in this particular place for so long. It's good to try something new. That's my big thing. Go out, all our listeners, go out and try something new today. Have something different for dinner. I'm feeling that's what I'm interested in, is people trying new things. Now, this is obviously a little more, has larger ramifications than many of the new things that some of us will try today. It's definitely controversial. It hits really close to home for a lot of people. I've been thinking quite a bit about the connections between Pope Francis's involvement in sort of creating a more open Cuba,
right,
and his movement on behalf of religious freedom and an end to religious persecution, some of the things that we were talking about before. Now,
right,
the church in Cuba is not in as much danger as the church in other places in the world, but it's certainly not completely free. Religious freedom is not perfectly accomplished in that nation right now. And it makes me wonder if this is sort of another way of the Pope trying to move towards religious freedom by either forcing or allowing, I guess you could look at it either way, forcing or allowing the country to engage more with the world through becoming a little more open. Will that also increase religious freedom?
Right. And that's just like a step for him. He wants to increase the dialogue and hoping that the dialogue will move towards religious freedom and human rights through this dialogue and reconciliation. You know, we've been so cut off and we've been so estranged for so long that I think it's not going to be an instant process.
I agree.
Now, one of my friends that I know, Maria Maria Johnson, she has written an article, and for all those interested, please Google it. Please look up. It is with Elizabeth Scalia, also known as the Anchoress, and it's entitled Conflicted, My Cuba, My People, My Distress, and My Hope. And one of the things that she speaks to as a daughter of Cuba is that it just, there's a surge of emotions for those that are of Cuban descent in reestablishing diplomatic ties between U.S. and Cuba. And there's a bit of mistrust. There's a bit of concern, I would say, about whether where this is really going and what it means for the Cuban-American people. She writes that, for me, the U.S. reestablishing relations with Cuba is not an abstract discussion in a political science class. It is about whispered prayers and public demonstrations. It's about masses said and tears shed and risks taken. It's about a search for justice without being certain of what it might look like. And, you know, to think about that when ties are reestablished, being Catholic, as she had noted, it means being able to forgive, being able to reconcile all those things that have happened before and being able to move forward.
Yeah, this is, it's so painful for so many people and for so many Americans, because many of the Cuban Americans are people who fled Cuba because of what was going on there. So I really feel for folks like your friend who are working through this and have this pain that they carry around with them. And I hope that this change can be something that does not exacerbate that pain.
Right. And she does note that, you know, one of the things that she says, perhaps reestablishing diplomatic relations is the first step in reestablishing human relationships. And that would be a solid positive. Yeah. And that, you know, she prays for peaceful resolution and a becalmed new beginning. So that is what our Catholic teaching gives us. It, in the midst of our conflictedness, in the midst of our confusion, it also calls us to that sense of hope and that understanding that peace is available, peace is possible, though not always the way that we had envisioned it.
And what a great example for her to set in this writing of, you know, finding what it is that we want to pray for. What is it that we're going to bring to God? I think with so many tragedies and hot button issues and things going on, and you know, there was just that awful shooting last night in Lafayette, and
yes,
the death of Sandra Bland in a prison, and you know, people sort of rehash their old arguments, and everyone clings to their ideologies, and everyone, you know, we tend to take sides. To focus on what is it that we can pray for in this situation? What's a holy response to this? Even if it's not our only response, you know, none of us is perfect. We're all gonna, you know, have moments when we're not reacting the best that we can, but to think, okay, what can I pray for in this situation? That's just a marvelous example. And I'm so glad you shared that quote.
Well, and I know we have just a few minutes before we go to break, but there were a lot of saints this week. And you know, the first thing I always tell my students is when you think that something is new or hasn't been done in the world, all we have to do is look towards the life of the saints. And we so clearly see that they have undergone the struggle and challenges that we face to today. And I think it's very supportive. It's very encouraging. It gives me hope to know that I am not alone in the struggle, in this situation where we want to hope and we want to look for those new beginnings. So when we look at the week, we had St. Apollinarius, we had St. Lawrence of Brindisi, we had the witness of Mary Magdalene, we have St. Bridget, and when we come back, I want to talk about a new saint that is really kind of making the headlines. But we're going to take a break, and we will come back here on An Engaging Faith with Elizabeth Reardon on Real Life Radio. We are back, and you are listening to An Engaging Faith with Elizabeth Reardon here on Real Life Radio. Now, feedback, join in the conversation. This is our last segment here, but if you wish to leave a comment for Margaret or I, you can reach me at theologyisaverb@gmail.com or through Twitter or Instagram. Margaret is on that as well, and her blog is margaretfelice.com, and mine is theologyisaverb.com. Now, before the break, we were talking about some of the different events going on in our Catholic faith. And also, I briefly touched on in the last 20 seconds some of the saints that we have celebrated in the history of the church this week. Now, today we have St. Charbel Mukluf, and his feast day is today. And what's interesting with him is that he is one of those saints from the Eastern Rite. And it's interesting that when we think about this call to be a saint, that it comes not just from those that have been living holy lives, you know, their entirety. You don't get necessarily the call as a baby. You get the call as you grow and you learn in your Christian faith that there is a different way to live out our faith. And although I think that what is remarkable this week is that there is a boy that has made the headlines called the Angel of Guatemala, and this child has chosen to death over gang violence. He was given a very real life or death choice.
Yeah, reading that story, I'm so glad you pointed it out to me because I hadn't heard it. This boy, I think he was 12, who living in Guatemala in an area that's really racked by gang violence, and was told by the gang members who sort of dominate his neighborhood that he had to shoot someone to become part of the gang or they were going to throw him off a bridge, and he wouldn't commit the act of violence. And I found that to be such an extraordinary example of integrity, even in such a young boy, just knowing who he was and the kind of person he was going to be, and that he was not going to be the kind of person who committed violence or was part of a gang. I think we can often underestimate children of that age, and we think that maybe decisions about who we're going to be come later. You know, in the United States, we tend to think, oh, college is when you make those decisions, but that's absolutely not true. We start to make decisions about the kind of person we're going to be very, very young, and this boy shows such a heroic, though tragic, example of that.
And I think that's what really sticks in our minds, is that to be able to make this decision at his age and to be fully willing to live, you know, that decision out, to face it right then and there in that second. I don't think any of us would have faulted him in some respects for having to make a different choice.
Yeah, it really puts into such striking terms the fact that there's so many people in the world and in the United States who are just presented with a lot of bad choices and not a lot of good options. you know, so many people are in these environments. You know, even President Obama visited a prison the other day and was talking about how the way the environments shape people, and that sometimes the lack of options and sort of the perversion of your environment when you're in such a violent situation can put choices in front of you that many of us in areas of privilege would never have to make. So, that just knowing that there are so many people in the world who are in these situations because of all the bad options that were presented to them, it just makes it that much more extraordinary to see a young man do something like this boy did.
Right. And I think you put very well what I was trying to, the point I was trying to say is that, yeah, these choices that we are given, they might be between what we're going to have for a meal, you know, this or that, not in the situation where we're having to choose between someone else's death or our own. And, you know, what I find very remarkable is that not only did he go through this fall of 400 feet, but when he recovered, or in his recovery, he was willing to talk about it.
Yeah.
That's another time where you're putting your life at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, you know, go quietly off.
Yeah. And be, I mean, who wouldn't be scared after something like that happened?
Right. So it just puts into to that wonderful frame of mind that we are being called, even in, even though we are not facing these life or death situations sometimes, that we are still being called to answer God in even the smaller ways. And we're talking about the books that have come across our desk lately, Margaret, and one of which you have read, Mercy in the City.
Yes, yes. I just finished that the other night. I was a little behind. I'd hoped to read it when it first came out, but I thought it was a really special book. And I know that you talked to the author, Carrie Weber, more than a month ago, a couple weeks ago. I can't even remember now. I thought it was such a clear, easy to read, practical book that talks about the kinds of things that we do in our real lives. It wasn't too theoretical. And one of the things that I liked as, a younger woman living in the city, only recently married. So all through my 20s and into my 30s, I was single, childless, and that's often a demographic that's not really reached by some devotional books. There's a tendency to focus on the vocation of motherhood, I think, in a lot of Catholic literature, which is, of course, a worthy path. Mm-hmm. But to see something that was pointed more towards my demographic was so refreshing. I felt like I could really relate to it.
Right. And I think what she does is she challenges our perspective to look at, well, what can I do in the city? I'm not in a foreign mission. I'm not in a situation maybe where I'm surrounded by people that desperately need my attention, you know, right away. Mm-hmm. I'm not living in a circumstance where it is that life and death. But what she's challenging is, well, so you're not. So then where are you being called to go?
Mm-hmm. And it might not be as glamorous as these other situations. We think, oh, we want to go far away and save the world. Well, there's plenty of world that needs to be saved right in our own backyards.
Plenty of occasions to show mercy. And mercy, I've always said, you know, we like to think of it as these big grand actions that we might partake in or experience or perform a few times in a lifetime, rather than, as Mother Teresa would say, these really small acts of great love in our everyday.
Yeah. One of the quotes that I took away was from one of the last chapters when she's quoting one of the Sisters of Mercy with whom she's close, who said, never let a woman stand alone. And then, of course, Carrie, the author, points out that it's more universal. It's not geared solely towards women. And I thought, what a marvelous guiding principle as I, in my personal life, continue to work on opening my heart in compassion and accompanying people and trying to make people comfortable and care for others, I just think that's such a concise and powerful guiding ideal.
I agree. I agree as well. And one of the other books that that we just covered this week is A Purposeful Path by Father Casey Beaumier of BC, whose book we are giving away on an Engaging Faith's Facebook page. So, you know, just as a taste, ever wonder where God is leading you and yearn to discover or explore your own vocation in life more fully? Well, this is where Father Casey's book really points us to go. And he takes us on his own journey as a Jesuit novice and on this pilgrimage of discerning his identity, vocation, and purpose in life.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to read that one yet, but I was at Mass with Father Casey Beaumier last weekend, and I was singing and he was preaching and presiding, and he's such a wonderful man and he's a great speaker. So I am more than willing to endorse that book without having read it quite yet. And I do also want to mention two other books that I've read recently quickly. One was called A Legacy by Sybil Bedford. It's a novel set in Germany around the turn of the 20th century. It was written decades ago, but it was phenomenal. And I never would have, I was surprised that I found it. So it's sort of a hidden gem, A Legacy. And also a book that just came out by Ed Suzuki, who's a Christian author and blogger. It's called First Draft Father, and you can find it on Amazon. It's only available as an ebook, but Ed Suzuki's First Draft Father was also a really great read.
And I'm going to put in a plug for Love and Salt. That is a book that we are going to be featuring the authors on Monday, two women that talk about their spiritual journey of friendship together. And it is an incredible book that culminates at least 5 years of their friendship and finding how God is working in their lives. So thank you for joining me here on Engaging Faith with Elizabeth Reardon on Real Life Radio.